May it please the court. David Cosma, on behalf of plaintiffs, appellants in this matter. This matter is before the court today on an order from the court dismissing this matter. There was a initial delay prevention order in this matter, directing counsel to show cause within 30 days why this case should not be dismissed, since service of process was not effectuated on defendants and not filed with the court. I failed to respond to that order due to inadvertence. It was tickled on my calendar, and I didn't respond.
Was the order to show cause, or was there a delay order or whatever?
Well, it was an initial delay prevention order, but I think in the order itself, the statement was to, you know, either serve and file, return of service on defendants, or show cause why.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly. And so the court dismissed the case ostensibly without prejudice, but the statute of limitations had expired on the case. So I moved to set aside the dismissal, explaining to the court that even though the order said it was without prejudice, it had the effect of being with prejudice because the statute of limitations had expired. And I saw the order from this court directing counsel to look at the line of cases stating that ordinary negligence does not equate to excusable neglect.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to make sure you're clear what I think we were asking. There's lots of law in the trial court relying on it that ordinary negligence is not excusable neglect.
Correct.
The line of cases that we cited to you said, but gross negligence can be excusable neglect.
Correct.
I suppose the question, and I would appreciate your addressing it, is, and I say, I know you're in a tough spot, Mr. Cosma. I appreciate the candor to the court, but for the grace of God, go any of us, I suppose, understand it. I guess the question is whether you believe that in this circumstance where the facts are where they are, was it gross negligence such that we send it back for the court to address that? It seems to me the question is whether the district court applied the right standard if these gross negligence cases apply.
Well, I can't, and I think the court did, and to be quite honest with you. But I just think it's an interesting rule, because the greater the malfeasance on the part of the attorney, the greater the likelihood that a judgment would be vacated. So. But I think the court should be a two-part analysis in this case, because ostensibly it was a dismissal without prejudice. Once the court was put on notice, the trial court was put on notice that it had the effect of a dismissal with prejudice, I think at that point the court had to apply the holding of beginning with Lake Meredith Reservoir Company, where a court exercises discretion in a dismissal, but in exercising that discretion in a dismissal for failure to prosecute, it has to examine certain factors: the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, any prejudice to the defendant, and the efforts that the prosecuting party has made to move the case forward. And so once the trial court was on notice that this was a dismissal with prejudice, or had the effect of being a dismissal with prejudice, I think the court was obligated to address those factors. And in this case, the delay was only 3 months. The clock starts ticking, or when you look at the factor of the length of the delay, it's not when the claim arose, it's when the suit was filed.
But the first factor is whether the counsel was negligent, which is what the court hung its hat on, right? The court said it was ordinary negligence, and many cases say that's not excusable neglect. I mean, that is, that's one of the three parts of the test.
Right, and I would ask the court, though, that when there's a dismissal, and it's a dismissal with prejudice, that trial courts are under an obligation to examine other factors rather than just, you know, just a hard, fast rule that, you know, if it's ordinary negligence, then the case is dismissed. It's just, it runs contrary to, you know, the cases that say that, you know, it's a dismissal. It's not to be a rule of forfeiture. I mean, there's more to it than just whether somebody missed a deadline. It's the facts and circumstances of the case and whether it's moving forward. And in this instance, the case, even it was moving forward. My clients came to me 2 months before the statute of limitations were about to expire. I had to round up medical records. I put together a settlement package. I forwarded it to the carrier. We were discussing settlement negotiations to avoid litigation. The case was filed to protect my client's claim. So I don't think it's such a big onus on the court just to examine the facts and the circumstances for the delay.
Well, here's the problem I have with this argument, and I'm going to come back to asking you whether you think the cases we cited to you in the order apply. I mean, the problem is, in terms of the original dismissal, the delay prevention order said, if you don't file this or a reason why you didn't get service done, the case will be dismissed. It said that, without prejudice, and the court did that.
Correct.
The court, then you moved to reconsider, and you're saying the court should have looked into the fact that there was no prejudice, and that it effectively was a motion dismissed with prejudice.
Correct.
And what I'm troubled by on that analysis is how we could possibly say it was an abuse of discretion. There are cases that say the fact that it affects a dismissal with prejudice does not bar the dismissal. There are cases out there that say that. The court heard you. You made the argument, and the court rejected it. And I find it a real uphill battle to say that's an abuse of discretion on the district court. You know, that's the standard of review we have. The court has a lot of discretion. And so I'd be interested in your addressing how we could say it's an abuse of discretion. And I'm still not sure I got an answer to my original question, which was, do the cases we cited about gross negligence apply here or not?
No, it doesn't. Gross negligence does not apply in this, because it wasn't gross negligence.
Does inadvertence apply here?
Well, inadvertence, I think, too, is in this. I mean, I hate to admit
it. What does that term mean in this environment? It says the judgment can be set aside for mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect.
Right.
And almost all the cases jump right to excusable neglect, which is a very high standard, if it's stridently applied. Was inadvertence something other than excusable neglect, lesser standard? What does it mean here?
Well, I'd like to say it means something different, but based on my research, I think it's probably equivalent to excusable neglect. They tend to lump all of that into one category. I appreciate the court's question, but I don't have any case law that defines that any differently than it does excusable neglect. But I think there should be a two-part analysis, my conduct and then the court's conduct. And then where, if there is going to be a dismissal with prejudice, the factors enunciated beginning with Lake Meredith and the line of cases after that, that you have to consider other factors. It's just not a hard and fast rule. You miss a deadline, you're out of the game. Let's look. You know, how long has this case been? How long ago was this case filed? What efforts are counsel making? Is there any prejudice to the defendant? And what efforts have been made to move it forward?
That has to do with setting aside the order, not whether the court enters it or not.
With the dismissal itself.
Yeah. But it's with a dismissal with prejudice.
Correct.
Do you have any case that says you apply that standard where, although the court dismissed without prejudice, it has the effect of a dismissal with prejudice? Is there any case like that you can cite to us?
The only case, it has to do with whether it's right for appeal. because I think the court entered an order in this case where the court asked me, why are we even hearing this if it was a dismissal without prejudice? But in the specific context you're asking, I don't.
I looked. I couldn't find one. I was curious if you had.
Yeah, I looked too.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's what I'm asking the court to do is to carve out an exception or to create a nuance if there is a dismissal and it is a dismissal with prejudice for a failure to prosecute, that a trial court is obligated to apply the factors enunciated in Lake Meredith in the line of cases after that, you know, most recently Edmund versus the City of Colorado Springs.
And what's the meaning in this environment? The court can't go through the evaluation you're going through because wanted to go through because they don't have any facts.
Well,
it gave you an order to show cause. If you have not served the defendant within a certain period of time, 30 days, then you must show cause why we shouldn't dismiss it.
Right. But
that's when you raise these arguments.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and the only reason I did is if the statute of limitations had not expired in your scenario, all right?
Just refile it.
Yeah, you refile
it. It's not $150. It's no
$120.18, okay. To be exact. So that would be, to me, that's you know, that sort of the punishment fits the crime in that scenario. But when the court was put on notice that the effect of the dismissal was a dismissal with prejudice.
I know, but that occurred afterwards. And that seems to me to be germane to the 60B motion, not to the court's original decision to dismiss.
Sure. But once the court was put on notice about the effect, then I think then the court's obligated to use the analysis. The length, that's my argument.
So you're making a 60B argument.
I'm making a 60B argument, also making an argument under the case law that talks about the factors that a court should examine when it exercises its discretion. And if it fails to examine those factors, the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, the prejudice to the defendant, and the efforts made, that when a court doesn't examine those factors, it's an abuse of discretion. That's my argument. I'll reserve any other time for
rebuttal. You want to reserve the balance?
For rebuttal, yes.
That's fine. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Henry Mata, registration 37412, present for Mr. Hibble. I'd like to start by addressing a few of plaintiff's points in his opening argument. Law should not be applied differently because he decided to file up against the statute of limitations. There was a series of decisions made by his clients when to pursue the lawsuit.
And then it statute of limitation runs while a lawsuit's pending. It's a two-year statute. Most lawsuits take longer. It could be dismissed later in the process on some sort of similar matter.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and it would be, in fact, a dismissal with prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. It was a three-year statute of limitations, and he filed within a few days of it expiring. And that decision took away the spare time he would have had to fix anything.
No, but I'm talking about other procedural problems that arise later under which a court might dismiss a case that's 2 years old, 3 years old. I mean, the same rule applies in both circumstances, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor, but my point is the situation that the spare time that would have been available to him was not available to him, but through a series of decisions made by both the clients and the attorney to file right near the end of the statute of limitations.
Let me ask you, is your client prejudiced? If the action were reinstated, is your client prejudiced?
Yes, Your Honor, I was about to get to that. In Colorado, there's a statute that requires 9% interest. It's an operation of law. Judges do not have discretion to ignore the interest rate. 9% is better than probably any investment you'll get these days. And now we're 4.5 to 5 years after the accident. This is a relatively minor rear-end accident in 2007. He decided to wait almost 3 years to file. Then, when he received the order, he didn't pursue service, my client was in Boulder. He just calendared it for the last day, again, taking any spare time he would have had, taking any additional weapon or tool he would have had to combat any problem, and he put it on the last day again.
How's that prejudice, Mr. Miniter? I mean, the problem I have with that argument is it applies to every personal injury case, no matter when somebody applies to, files the case 2 years in. That 9% prejudgment interest rate was running. You could make the same argument. It's prejudicial. I mean, it is what it is. Did your client rely to his detriment here in any way? Obviously, you would love to have a free pass ride. You're done, no judgment, regardless. And we of course don't know the facts of the underlying case at all. I get that, but I don't think that's legal prejudice. I mean, was there any reliance to your client's detriment here at all?
They should have the benefit of the statute of limitations, which was 3 years, and now we're 4.5 years.
The case was filed on time. That's the problem. The case was filed within the statute of limitations. You're getting the benefit of a mistake of not filing, getting the thing served and filing a return of service. That's what we're talking about.
But now there'd be an additional time factored in at the 9% interest rate. There'd be additional interest. There'd be an additional sum on top of the judgment that exists now that wouldn't exist.
Well, let's say the plaintiffs here filed the return of service as they were supposed to. I mean, you're in the same boat. Basically, as I understand it, the case got dismissed relatively quickly after that deadline went by. You're talking about 2 or 3 extra days that the court reinstated it. I mean, there would have been no problem that they filed it on time, the return of service or some notice. Instead, they didn't. Court dismissed. A day or two later, there's a motion for reconsideration. Had the court granted it, you were talking about a 5-day window, a couple of day window.
If he had served my client and the case proceeded normally, the case would be resolved by now.
Let me ask you this question. He was apparently engaged in negotiations with the insurance carrier.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he submitted a package, and I didn't practice much, if at all, in this area, but is there any tacit understanding that when you're doing this, you don't serve the party and get everybody involved in litigation until you've tried to settle it?
No, Your Honor. In fact, as a business practice, there's an automatic form letter sent out that anything that's ongoing negotiations does nothing to the statute of limitations.
Pardon?
There's a form letter routinely sent out to plaintiff's counsel who are in negotiations, warning them of the statute of limitations and warning them that...
Oh, no, but he filed it. I mean, he filed the case. He filed it timely under the statute.
Yes.
I'm talking about delaying service on the party because the statute's been protected by the filing of the complaint.
Yes, Your Honor. No, there's no agreement to...
No understanding or informal practice that would lure counsel into feeling that he didn't have to serve the other side.
No, Your Honor. No informal practice. I have seen written agreements to tolling it and to agreeing to toll the statute for a period of time. For example, there's further medical treatment contemplated or something along those lines, but it's in writing. And there was no such agreement here, and there's no such agreement in the record.
Was there any request to accept service voluntarily that you know of?
None that I know of, Your Honor. I searched the record in our files. The only action I'm aware of is him writing it on the paper calendar the day before he's supposed to do something instead of simply serving my client, who's a long-term resident of Boulder County.
Can I ask you, Mr. Mitchell, what do you think about these gross negligence cases that we cited in the order? I can guess, but I'd rather hear your argument.
I did research, obviously, Your Honor, and I agree with the United States Supreme Court position on this. It doesn't make the differentiation between gross negligence and negligence. Essentially, every act of an attorney under Justice Harlan's analysis in Link v. Wabash Railroad 370 U.S. 626 is that we have a representative system in civil litigation, and therefore litigants are bound by the actions of their attorneys. And to quote Justice Harlan, he found no merit to the argument that dismissal imposes an unjust penalty on the client. Plaintiff voluntarily chose their attorney as a representative and cannot avoid the consequences of that.
Well, isn't that inconsistent, though, we cited the two cases, Valley Bank and Sumler. I mean, Sumler is just the Colorado Supreme Court, which I'm bound by, says that an attorney's gross negligence could not be imputed to the client, and gross negligence causing a default judgment was excusable. Valley Bank cited the same principle. I mean, that's the principle of law that binds this division, I think.
I understand that's the binding law in Colorado, but as Mr. Cosma conceded, this is negligence. This is carelessness. This is not gross negligence. Gross negligence is more of a conscious disregard of a known risk, or it's a much, much higher level of negligence than simply not seeing something on your paper calendar or not serving somebody within 30 days. This is the equivalent of somebody deciding to drive down the highway without a spare tire, without leaving yourself the extra time, without making sure that you're serving, without having a backup system to your calendar. That's negligence. He went down the road without the spare tire, without the way to fix a problem if it happened. Because any problem that happened would be at the last minute, and we'd be in this situation. That's just carelessness. And it gives me no pleasure to characterize that in that fashion, but the case must be looked at in terms of stare decisis. It must be looked at in the application of law and how it affects the fabric of law in Colorado. I understand the result is harsh, but every pancake has two sides. The other side is we have somebody on the other side, Mr. Hibble, who deserves a certainty provided by the statute of limitations, who has a meter running against him, 9% interest, and now we have an additional year and a half into a case. And generally in Colorado, these kind of cases are resolved within a year of filing or well before filing. Now we're sitting here in 2012 talking about a 2007 accident because he didn't respond to a delay prevention order, because he didn't serve somebody who lives in Boulder County. That's the process. And I understand the court taking into analysis the harsh remedy, but there's a harsh remedy on the other side as well. I think a review of the record reveals that the trial court acted upon competent evidence, that they did not abuse their discretion, that they issued an order, and they didn't just immediately wait for the order to expire. They waited a few weeks later than that, and still they had no response from plaintiff's counsel. The record shows that he didn't serve process. He didn't have a backup system or a secondary check and balance on the way that he went about this in this particular case, that he waited to near the last day of statute, and that he calendared for near the last day that the order gave him. That's negligence under the black letter law in Colorado. It's imputed to the client.
Would you address, Mr. Minerva, the other issues? Mr. Cosma says you got to look at all these various factors, prejudice and the like. How does that weigh in? I guess Judge Roy also kind of alluded to this. Yeah, I mean, I get the argument. You say it's ordinary negligence that gets imputed to the client. Do we look to issues like prejudice and the equities once we get there, which are the normal factors under 60B?
Thank you for asking that question, Your Honor. I was going to bring up Radinsky v. Karras, I'm pronouncing the name correctly, 511 Pacific 2nd, 953, where this court considered the statute of limitations to be a factor, and it is a factor. And obviously the trial court had access to the record, knew that statute of limitations pertaining to this action, and was made aware of it by counsel, and it was a factor. And just because it does exist doesn't create an exception in the law. You don't get an additional benefit because you've decided to wait to the edge of the statute to create this problem. The law applies whether he decided to file with 6 months left in the statute or a year or what have you. It's a factor. He proposed a new test for these kind of analysis, but the fact is it's already a factor under Radinsky. And the court knew of it. And of course, what is at issue here is whether the court abused its discretion, not whether we agree with what the court did, but whether there was a good, competent evidence in the record for what the court did. And there is. The court did not abuse its discretion.
Terms counsel frequently run into the same problem when a default is entered against their client. You want the same standard applied there?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. If there are no further questions, I'd like to ask the court to affirm the ruling of the trial court because it wasn't an abuse of discretion, because the decision was made on a good and competent record supported by facts, and it conforms to Colorado law in that ordinary negligence is imputed to the client. Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a couple things to answer questions that the court addressed to opposing counsel. There is an informal practice between plaintiff's counsel and insurance carriers when a suit is filed and a defendant is not served. And usually the informal practice is, as long as we continue to negotiate in good faith and work, and we're working toward a settlement, defendant will not be served. Because typically, once the defendant is served, many times it goes out of one claim adjuster's hands as a matter of company policy and immediately goes to the attorney.
And it may well be true what you're saying, Mr. Cosman, but is there anything in the record that would allow us to rely on that?
Well, just in the pleadings that when I moved to reconsider, it was my statement to the court that there are no ongoing negotiations. But beyond that, there's nothing in the record. It was tickled on my calendar when I received the delay prevention order from the court. It was immediately tickled. It was just when it came to that time, I missed it. Otherwise, I would have filed them.
Well, the reason I asked the question of counsel is that it seems to me in the normal course, if you get a delay reduction order, your first reaction is serve the person. Just issue the summons and get it served. Right. Rather than wait and try to show cause why you didn't, right, you would just serve the person. And it seemed to me, I was just looking to see if there was any explanation of why you didn't serve this person.
Because there were ongoing negotiations. Okay. And many times it's like as soon as you serve a defendant, it's out of the adjuster's hands, it's on to the attorney, and you're back to square one. And so any progress you made in negotiation up to that point was, you know, is for naught. So that's, I mean, that's the practice.
That's the practicality.
Yes, 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 Your Honor. To answer the question about insurance counsel run into problems with default judgment where I've served people, they don't notify their carrier. I've got entry of default judgment, and the carrier all of a sudden is aware of it, and I've never had those default judgments are almost always overturned. Thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate it.
Thank both counsel for argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. The